من يرد الله به خيرا يفقهه في الدين.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Outlining Fiqh, dear listeners, a podcast where we, the students and faculty at Timbuktu Seminary, sketch in your minds an outline of fiqh in an auditory design. Imagining deeply, your hearts would delight, and through outlining the 38 chapters of fiqh, a spark would ignite. Our mindset, our manners, our conduct intact, the laws of fiqh and how we should act. We have with us today Sheikh Abu Toba and several students of fiqh from around the world. So bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. How are you, Sheikh?
Alhamdulillah, ana bi khair wa alhamdulillah. Wa anta?
Alhamdulillah.
Hey, alhamdulillah. Let's get started then.
Now, this is a summary of Islamic jurisprudence by Sheikh Saleh Fozan, Unit 4, Chapter 1. Which begins on page 200 of the PDF and page 183 of the book. And this is the reclamation of wastelands.
Okay.
The fuqaha, may Allah have mercy on them, define a wasteland as a land which is not reserved for utilities or possessed by a legally protected owner. This definition excludes two types of lands. One, private land, a land owned by a legally protected Muslim or disbeliever, whether he's bought it, took it as a gift, or the like. Two, public land, a land reserved or specified for the benefit of private properties, such as roads, yards, and watercourses, or reserved for the utility of the residents, such as cemeteries, garbage dumps, areas reserved for performing the prayers of the two feasts, the Eids, places of firewood, and pastures. All such kinds of land cannot be legally possessed by means of reclamation.
Continue.
If the land which is not possessed by any legally protected owner is reclaimed by someone, it belongs to him due to the following hadith narrated by Jabir, may Allah be pleased with him, in which the Prophet ﷺ said, what may mean, if anyone brings a barren land into cultivation, then it belongs to him. Compiled by Imam Ahmad and At-Tirmidhi, who deemed it a sahih, authentic hadith. There are other ahadith having the same meaning. Some of them are recorded in Sahih Bukhari, Al-Bukhari's authentic book of hadith. All fuqaha agree that the wastelands can be possessed by those who reclaim them, except the wastelands of Al-Haram, the sanctuary of Mecca, and the area of Arafah, the mount, so as not to narrow the places specified for the pilgrims to perform the rituals of Hajj or occupy a space specified for all people. However, fuqaha differ in determining the conditions required to make valid the reclamation of a barren or ownerless land.
Okay, alhamdulillah. This is a beautiful law of Islam, which shows that people have the right to land. The governments don't have a right to charge you money to go find unused land and use it. Okay? This means, this shows that the people have a right to land that's not being used. Uncultivated land that no one else is using is the right of the one who goes and finds it and starts to using it. And no one can come to them and tell them, look, you cannot use this land. You have to pay me for it. It's not your land. You're not using it. And if it's not being used and a person begins to use it, he has now claimed that land for himself. And Allah has given him a right to that. And Islam declares that right. Alhamdulillah. And the earth is much more spacious than people realize. So there should be enough place for a person to find some place for himself and, you know, be able to establish himself if he moves around. And this is from the statement of Allah. when the people claim and they die as they are oppressing themselves, the angels are going to come to them and say, what was your situation? And they will reply, we were oppressed in the land. That's why we couldn't get this done. That's why this happened. Remember, Allah described them as oppressing themselves. And the angels are going to rebuke them, meaning they're not going to accept this as an excuse and say, wasn't there the planet that Allah made wide enough, spacious enough, that you could have moved and gone somewhere else? So, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Continue.
Naam. A wasteland can be legally possessed in some ways. First, when a person surrounds a wasteland with an invulnerable wall, it becomes his. For the Prophet ﷺ said, what may mean, if anyone surrounds a land, i.e. a wasteland, with a wall, then it belongs to him. Compiled by Imam Ahmed and Abu Dawood.
Okay, so this title is incorrect. A wasteland can be legally possessed. No, these are signs that declare, show that the wasteland has been legally claimed, okay? And then that claim has to be respected. One of the signs is when the person surrounds the land that he's using with a wall, a man-made wall, okay? He takes the time to put a wall around it, then that's his, okay? And now you go to the hadith, if anyone surrounds a land with a wall, then it belongs to that person. Okay, related by Imam Ahmed and Abu Dawood on the authority of Jabir ibn Abdullah and Ibn Jarud, and it was deemed sahih, authentic. Continue.
Naam.
Question.
There is an...
Complete this paragraph. There's another hadith.
There's another hadith narrated on the authority of Samura carrying the same meaning, stating that when a person surrounds a barren or ownerless land with a wall, it becomes his, provided that such a wall is strong and impregnable enough. However, if a person just puts stones or earth around a wasteland, or surrounds it with a low fence or a small wall that does not prevent intruders, or digs a trench around it, the land still does not belong to him, yet he is more entitled to reclaim it. Moreover, it is impermissible for one to sell a wasteland unless one has fully reclaimed it.
Okay, so it cannot be a half effort. It has to be a full effort. So the effort of putting up a wall that would prevent a normal person from entering into the land. That shows that the fence has to be high enough to prevent a normal person from coming. And that means that that's usually a 10-foot fence, you know, 7-foot, because the average person is under 7 foot tall. So it would have to be over the head of the normal person. Okay, go ahead. Now, there was a question someone stated?
No, it was answered.
Continue.
Naam. Second, if a person digs a well in a wasteland until he reaches water, then it belongs to him as he has reclaimed it. However, if one digs a well with... Yes. However, if one digs a well without getting any water, the wasteland does not belong to him, though he is still more entitled to reclaim it and own it since he has started his reclamation. Third, if a person supplies a wasteland with water from a well or river, he thus has reclaimed it, as providing water is more useful to the land than surrounding it with the wall. Fourth, if there is water that overflows into a wasteland and causes it to be infertile, one who prevents or drains such water is considered to be reclaiming the wasteland, and thus it becomes his. This is because this kind of reclamation is more useful to the land than surrounding it with the wall, which makes one owns it, according to the aforementioned hadith.
Okay, so what you see here in these four actions are the humanization of that land, and the benefiting of that land, even for more than just the person who did the activity. By draining the land and providing a runoff so that the water doesn't make it into a swamp, you know, where the water is sitting and it becomes netting, you know, stale. and filled with bugs, then this is a positive thing, and it shows that the human touch has been put on here, the intelligent human touch, the beneficial human touch has been placed on here. And the same thing can be said about the other actions, you know, putting a wall around it so that there could be an inhabitation in there, digging a well so that the people can benefit and drink from it, okay? Or drawing the water so that it does come in there in a way that benefits the land and does not flood it, or if it already has been flooded, to drain it off so that people can use it in a beneficial way and it not ruin the land. All these actions show the humanization, the civilization, and the socialization of that land. And in doing so, the person has legally claimed that land for his own self. And his claim has to be respected according to the laws of Islam. Okay? Doesn't have to pay a down payment or any of those things that people claim that they have to do with it, reclaim a piece of land. Continue.
Nah. Some scholars maintain that there is no general rule to determine the cases in which a wasteland is deemed reclaimed, and that a Muslim must adhere to the common convention in this regard. What people conventionally consider to be reclamation of a wasteland entitles one who does it to possess the land. This is the opinion maintained by a group of the Hanbali scholars and others. The Sharia, Islamic law, states as a general rule that a wasteland is owned by whoever reclaims it without elaboration. So, a Muslim must refer to the common convention to find out what is deemed reclamation and what is not.
Okay, this is what's called when there is a general rule. And it's specific, when anything you say about it, there, it's still open for interpretation. And this law goes back to what we call earth, okay? The customs, the traditions, you know, what is the norms in that area for a person to consider. For everyone, anyone who heard about it would say, yes, that person did whatever he needed to do for the reclamation of that land, okay? So that's what this is saying. And this is because the people and their geographic areas and customs differ. However, what is not allowed is that he has to pay for it. Okay, because here we see that he's reclaiming it through his actions. Okay, through the natural actions. Continue.
Nah. The imam of Muslims, the ruler or the one in authority, is permitted to grant the wasteland to whoever reclaims it. For the Prophet ﷺ granted the valley of Al-Aqiq in Medina to Bilal ibn al-Harith and a land in Hadramaut to Wa'il ibn Hujr. The Prophet ﷺ also granted fiefs to Umar ibn al-Khattab, Uthman ibn Affan.
Fiefdoms, okay? Little small kingdoms. Continue.
Naam. To Umar ibn al-Khattab, Uthman ibn Affan, and their group of companions, may Allah be pleased with them all. Still, the one who is granted a wasteland as a fief does not own it until he reclaims it so as to become worthier than others to possess it. Thus, if the one granted the wasteland reclaims it, then it belongs to him. Yet if he cannot, the imam is permitted to retake the wasteland and grant it to someone else able to reclaim it. For Umar ibn al-Khattab, may Allah be pleased with him, took back the fiefs from those who could not reclaim them. Likewise, if one takes possession of a game animal, firewood or the like, before others do, one becomes more entitled to possess it, provided that he gets it first.
Okay, so again, the purpose of this statement is to show that even if it's granted and you don't do anything with it, it's not yours. Okay, you can't just hold it and when someone else goes and does benefit, no, that's my land, and now you charge them. No, This is proof that it's not yours until you do something with it. You make it livable or civilize it or make it socially, you know, relevant. Okay? And this is a beautiful law, again, for the granting of it for people who benefit it, who do something with the land. And so it's not just sitting there without any benefit. Continue.
Now, if a natural watercourse, such as that of a river or a valley, passes through people's lands, it is permissible for those by whose lands the water passes first to irrigate their lands, withholding water from others until it gathers and its height becomes equal to that of one's ankles. Then they should allow it to flow to those next to them, and so on and so forth. The Prophet ﷺ said to Zubayr on a similar occasion, what may mean, O Zubayr, irrigate your land and then withhold the water until it reaches the walls between the pits around the trees. Compiled by Al-Bukhari and Muslim.
Okay, so you see the length that is allowed to dam up. It's not that high, okay? It's just enough to go over the grass, and that's enough to irrigate and plant anything you want and not drown the land, ruin the land as well. And not holding it back so that it's preventing the neighbors from being able to benefit from it in a timely fashion. Continue.
Now, Abdul Razak related that Ma'mar reported that Az-Zuhri said, when we consider the Prophet's words, then withhold the water until it reaches the walls between the pits around the trees, we found that the height meant in the hadith equals that of one's two ankles. Thus, they measured the amount of water described in the hadith and found out that it was as high as the ankles. Then they made this amount a measurement to determine the target amount of water, after which everyone should allow water to flow to his neighbors to irrigate from it successively. Amr ibn Shu'aib narrated that the Prophet ﷺ said about the torrents of Mahzur, a well-known valley in Medina, what may mean. It, water, should be withheld until its height becomes equal to that of one's ankles. Then let the water descend from the higher land, next to which water passes first, to the lower land. Compiled by Abu Dawood and other compilers of hadith.
Again, this is the general rule. When the water is flowing naturally from a higher place to a lower place, how much you can hold before you have to allow it to spill over. Because this is a natural way of Allah making the earth beneficial. And so we should not stop it for our own just and hoard it. We're not allowed to hoard it. We can slow it down so we can benefit from it. But we cannot hoard it so that the others do not get to use it. Continue.
Now, if the water is owned by some landowners, it should be divided among its owners according to their properties, as each owner is permitted to do whatever he likes to his water share.
That's if the water is on each of their land equal to some degree. The water is owned by some landowners, meaning the water touches on my property, your property, and someone else's property as well. Continue.
Nah. The Imam of Muslims, the ruler or the one in authority, has the right to protect the pasture reserved for grazing the cattle belonging to the Muslims' public treasury, such as the horses of jihad, fighting in the cause of Allah, and the camels of charity, as long as this does not narrow the public areas. Ibn Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, narrated that the Prophet ﷺ specified a place called An-Naqi' as a protected area for grazing the horses of Muslims. So, as long as he does not narrow the Muslims' public places and it is needed, it is permissible for the imam to protect the grass grown in a wasteland for the grazing of the camels of charity, the horses of Muslim fighters, the cattle of jizya, and the straying and wandering cattle.
So there could be a federal reserve. This is federally reserved land. But the federal reserved land cannot be so much that, like you said, it restricts the people from using land. Okay? So we see the opposite of this in countries nowadays. The country claims all the wasteland for itself. It does not allow any of its citizens to go and reclaim any land, as the law has given them the right to do so. And this causes financial strain on the people. Continue.
Now, this is the end of the chapter. So we can continue to chapter 2.
So do we have any question about that? We see the tremendous benefit of that law, allowing people freedom to reclaim land. If people were to be allowed this route, they would go out and search for reclaimable land all over the planet, reclaim it, and start living their lives.
Yes. I wish we could do that. In Senegal, you can. So one of the things I don't think a lot of people realize, in America, I just learned this, and I was, really, really shocked. Basically, the government owns all the land, and that's why we have to pay so many taxes. Because technically, they own the land, and your taxes are essentially, your rent. Like, if the government was a medieval feudal lord, mm-hmm. essentially, and then to live on and use land, you would have to pay the feudal lord, except it's the American government.
It is the exact same thing. The American government is actually a corporation that has been incorporated in Britain. So it is exactly that. They're the landlord, and the landowner is actually Britain. And the company is that it's working as, doing business as, is the United States of America. And it's for that reason you see that Walt Disney refused to pay money in Florida for taxes and things like that. They said, we're only going to pay the real owner of the land. And they went and said they used an old British rule. And you can Google that and you'll see that particular issue where they brought it up.
Can any of the rest of us say, I'm only going to pay the last living relative of, I forget.
That's exactly what they said. I'm only going to pay the relatives of the king. And that's living relatives. I think that the king is still around because he was married to the queen. And that's what they claim. Now, I don't know why and how they can get away with it, or if it's just a rich people thing that they went through and they just shut up when they say that. I don't know.
No, I was just curious if we could do that. In America right now, people are leaving New Jersey, for example, and coming here because some of their taxes are $14,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 a year for a house. And they just can't.
Yeah, No, I don't know. I really don't understand the word play they have in the United States where they claim the land, and it's not their land in the first place, but it goes back to their claim of manifest destiny. And so we set it so it's ours, and if you don't agree, then we'll kill you. I mean, that's basically what the United States says. You know, so the rule, I just looked it up. It's called the King Charles III Royal Lives Clause, okay, saying the King of England, in fact, is the owner of the King of the United States, okay, et al. So,
wow. Look that up.
Right.
Say the name of the rule one more time.
Disney used a Royal Lives Clause, quote unquote, specifying King Charles III, in asterisks, is the King of England, when he is in fact the King of the United Kingdom et al. And et al. Means includes the United States. From a legal standpoint, and this syntax, he is the King of the United States. And this is because the War of Independence was resolved in a treaty agreement. Okay, so it's not a treaty like you think between two different countries. They just agreed to allow them to run it themselves, but they still own everything. Okay?
That just makes you reevaluate all your life choices. So that had that question then. Well, I don't know if it's appropriate for this conversation. I'll ask it after we finish with the recording. Thank you.
Okay, hold it. It says hold on. To people incorrectly confusing to the United Kingdom and England. I mean, we literally have entire Bible choice. United Kingdom law clause is referring to United Kingdom law. Reality, like the contractual interpretation. You review the clause of the King's context. King George of England is referring to the current reigning British monarch. So they're just I was just reading the law, trying to see what they were saying, you know. The other person, the lawyer that's talking about this, is not very clear about how the law is as well. You know, the problem is the reason why the people are unable to comprehend is because they do not understand that the War of Independence did not bring about independence. That's what the problem is. Okay, that's the thing. The scam of the United States being free, you know, it didn't. That's why they had to adopt English common law from 1776 and not the Scottish Civil War. Okay. And so they have they're using the rule of perpetual contracts in English common law. Okay.
Now,
and in English common law, it says English common law is they set the date as the death of the last living descendant of the current monarch plus 21 years. Okay, so the last living descendant of Queen Elizabeth II plus 21 years as the end date. Now that Charles III is the reigning monarch of England and is the English common law that the U.S. adopted, this is the boilerplate phrase they will use. Okay?
Sorry, Chef. Could you repeat that one more time? I was trying to catch that and I missed it.
That in English common law, basically, there has to be a date mentioned, okay, for the end date of the contract. And they used to set, it was common in England, to set this date as the date of the death of the last living descendant of the current monarch, whoever it was during the life that the contract was being made, plus 21 years. Okay, and this was based on centuries of court decisions. And this was something that could be determined, so that's why they did it. So now he's saying that King Charles III is the reigning monarch of England, and it is English common law that the U.S. has adopted. So that's the rule of thought, and he's not, you know, Disney's not going to pay because really, the United States is just a proxy for England. Okay? So he's not going to pay the proxy.
Okay, so he's only going to pay. So does that mean that date is a rolling date?
If you mean by that, that there is no actual date, then yes. If you mean by that, when does it start, then that's another point that is not clear. It's just that Disney chose the living monarch right now. And as long as their monarchy is alive, yes, then I believe that what can be said is it's going on perpetually. until the whole, all the kings die altogether. But I don't think that's possible since they keep having children, right?
Right. Understood.
Below Island. The point, though, is not actually that. The point is that he was able to legally claim and show that what we call the United States of America is not actually the landowner. That's the point. Not that he, you know, when the date will actually be or which monarch he claimed. The fact that he was unchallenged in the court, and the court did not shut him down for saying that this thing we call the United States of America is not the landowner. I'm going with the landowner, which is King Charles. You understand? That's the point. And no one has said anything and said, oh, he's wrong and they should, you know, this is a game. No, they didn't say anything. They just shut up.
Nah. Question.
Okay. Continue.
Wait, I think Berica just said question. Did you have a question?
Go ahead. I meant, go ahead. Yes.
I didn't say that.
You.
Nah. Question I had is how does Britain being the king of Britain being the actual landowner, how does that play in with the US's intention to build a wall around its land?
Nothing. It has nothing to do whatsoever. The king of England doesn't have the same rules of wasteland that Islam has. This wall that you're talking about now is a defensive wall. If you're talking about the wall for Mexico, you know, that's something totally different.
Understood.
That's just, you know, political. And in actuality, as Trump was making the, you know, his rounds against the Lady Kamala, whatever her name is, he said how they have made, the Democrats have made an agreement with the Mexican cartels to supply them with 300, well, so far, they had 320-something thousand children to come across that same place where there's supposed to be a wall. And all of those children, or that amount, have gone missing in sex trafficking. Okay, or they've been sent to the chop lands. So, and he said that she was informed of that, you know, and that was a big deal, and she hadn't done anything about it. And I thought that that was pretty amazing, that she had no actual defense about that and actually acknowledged that it was true. You know, that to me, that was like the any husnul dhan that you might have given to these people, any that you might have given to them that they are oblivious to some of these things, goes out the window. And you have to acknowledge at some point that these people are just human devils and that they are actually proactively doing the things that it seems that they're doing. And Trump said, well, wow, you know, when I come in, I'm going to use the military to stop them. It's not because he didn't know these things were going on. It's not like it's not common knowledge to them. So, you know, the wall is only a political tool being used to make some people in this society think that it's stopping immigration. In reality, it never stopped the drug war or the drugs coming across the border. It never stopped the guns from going the opposite direction, and has now not stopped the influx of immigration, and nor that we care. I don't care if we have people coming from anywhere, but as they pretend like that's an issue, the wall hasn't stopped anybody from coming into the country at either. So it's just a political, you know, word they use whenever they want to. I hope that makes sense.
Understood. Yes, sir.
But it has nothing to do with the ownership of the country.
Yes, sir.
Is there any other questions about this? Go ahead.
Now, moving on to chapter 2, which is job wages, ja'ala. According to the Sharia, Islamic law, job wages refer to the wage given to someone for some help or work he does. In other words, they refer to the fixed amount of money given by someone to another for the latter's performance of a certain task, such as erecting a wall. The permissibility of job wages is demonstrated in the Quran. Allah, exalted be He, states in the Quran that Yusuf, Joseph, said what may mean, and for he who produces it is the reward of a camel's load, and I am responsible for it. Quran, Surah
Yusuf, I'm going to guarantee it. The translation is that I'm responsible for it, meaning I'm guaranteeing it. I'm going to guarantee the payment. Okay? And he's talking about the production of the king's cup. So he says, whoever finds it, this works for him, I will guarantee the payment for a camel's load. Continue.
Now, the meaning is that whoever reports about the thief who has stolen the measure of the king will get a camel's load as a job wage. Thus, the aforesaid Quranic ayah implies the permissibility of giving wages. Its permissibility is also stated in the Sunnah, prophetic tradition, through the hadith about the stung person, narrated on the authority of Abu Sa'id in the two Sahihs and in other books of hadith. Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, may Allah be pleased with him, narrated, some of the Prophet's companions went on a journey until they reached some of the Arabs' tribes at night. They asked the latter to treat them as their guests, but they refused. The chief of that tribe was then bitten by a snake or stung by a scorpion, and they, his people, tried their best to cure him, but in vain. They went to the group of the companions and asked whether they had a treatment or not. One of them replied, yes, by Allah, I can recite a religious incantation for a cure, a ruqya, but as you have refused to accept us as your guests, I will not recite the religious incantation for you unless you fix for us some wages for it. They agreed to pay them a flock of sheep. So he, that companion, went with them and kept blowing and reciting the Surah of Al-Fatiha, the opening chapter of the Quran, over the stung man, who became all right, as if he was released from a chain, i.e. showing no signs of sickness. Thereupon, they paid them, the companions, the wage they agreed to pay. After that, they, the companions, came to the Prophet ﷺ and narrated the whole story to them, upon which he ﷺ said what may mean, you have done the right thing. Divide it, the wage, among yourselves, and assign a share for me as well.
Naam. It's a well-known hadith, like he said, and there's other places in the Quran that show that as well. When you see the story of Musa and Khadr, when Khadr erects the wall with Musa, and Musa says, well, why didn't you charge them for it? We could have gotten the wages for this, you know? And so that becomes the breaking point for him in Khadr. So what's clear in the Sunnah and in the Sharia in general, the Quran, is that a person can be paid for services he renders. Okay? Continue.
Now, if the person performs the work for which a certain wage is specified, then he deserves it, for the agreement is validated by the performance of the specified task. If a group of workers performs a task, the wage is to be equally divided among them, for they participate in performing the same job, for which the specified wage is paid. Whoever works when no wage is stipulated does not deserve anything, as it is considered a task performed without the permission of the employer, and thus the worker does not deserve any wage or reward. However, if the wage is stipulated after he has started the worker deserves only the appropriate amount of the wage according to the work done after the stipulation of the wage. Giving wages to a worker is a permissible agreement. Therefore, both parties, the worker and the employer, are entitled to cancel it. If the worker cancels the agreement, he deserves no wage or reward. for he thus drops his own right. However, if the employer cancels the agreement after the worker starts, the worker deserves an appropriate portion of the wage according to what he has already performed, for which compensation is due. Giving wages, ja'ala, is different from hiring people's services, ijara, in some aspects. Among them are the following.
Okay, so first, let's understand what he said thus far. Okay, so first, the wage is due when it's specified before the work begins. The wage is due for the one who gets up and does it. If no wage has been declared for any action and the person just goes on its own and does it, the owner of, let's say, the property or whatever the thing is, does not have to pay anything because he had not declared a wage for that particular service. For example, if my car is outside my house and someone comes and washes my car, and they didn't ring my doorbell, they didn't ask me if they should wash my car, or how much will I get for washing my car, they just do it, I'm not obliged to pay them anything. If I come out while they're washing my car and I say, okay, you know, I'll give you $5 for washing my car, then in this instance, since it's a small thing like a car, then the price is set at that point. If it's a number of cars, and I say, I'll give you $5 for every five cars you wash, and, you know, I have 20 cars and they already did five, they only get the wages for 15 cars. Because the price naming the fee that I would pay came after they did the first five that I didn't ask or stipulate them to do. Okay. So when both parties agree, then anyone can cancel from his side. But if they do, there are conditions. So if the worker agrees to do the work and then gets halfway done and quits, then, you know, he doesn't get anything. Okay. However, if he gets halfway done and I say, well, you know what, I'm canceling this, then he gets the amount for doing half the work. Okay, does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
All right, now it differs from ijara in particular ways he's going to name right now. Go ahead and make the 6 points.
Nah. In job wages, it is not a prerequisite for the validity of the agreement to specify accurately the task for the worker to perform in return for the wage. Yet specifying the service is a condition for the validity of hiring. Ijara.
Okay, so the wages, it doesn't say that it doesn't have to be right on point. You can say, generally, I want you guys to clean up this area. Okay? That doesn't specify accurately the task. Whereas if it's ijara, it has to be very clear what your service is to be done. Continue.
It is not a condition for the validity of wages to specify a certain period for the task to be done in return for the wage, unlike hiring, whose validity stipulates that the period of work must be specified.
So if I'm going to hire you as a service person, then I'm saying I want this area, the walls cleaned, the floor swept, the furniture moved around, and everything done within 2 hours. But if it's just wages, then no time frame, just get it done.
I see. To continue, it is permissible in job wages to stipulate both the task and the period during which this task is to be performed. For example, one can say, whoever sews this garment for me in one day deserves such and such as wages. In such a case, if the worker sews the garment in one day, he deserves the specified wage. Otherwise, he deserves nothing. However, in hiring, it is impermissible for the employer to stipulate both the service and the time during which it is to be done, i.e. the worker receives his wages once he performs his work.
That's clear. Continue.
In case of job wages, one is not obliged to perform the task, but in hiring, the hired person is obliged to perform the service.
Okay, hold on. Let me go back. Maybe it's not clear. Let's say he says about sewing something. If I get it done today, or I want it done by tomorrow, Otherwise, he says, okay, I'm going to make you a suit. You know, make me a suit. And the guy says, okay, I'll make you a suit. Then there's no time frame for that. Once the suit is made, then he gets his wage. Okay? But the other one, he said, I need my pants sewn or my shirt, you know, tailored by tomorrow. So there's a difference. In the case of job wages, one is not obliged to perform the task. Okay, because it's out there. Whoever makes me a suit, no. But in hiring, the hired person is obliged to perform the service because he made an agreement, a contract for him to do the service. Continue.
So, Sheikh, this concept of Ju'ala, this is really like what they said in Surah Yusuf, where someone says, I will give this much money to whoever can do this. It's not like being hired for a job like most of us are, like in our jobs.
Right, and this is for the reason why we see the hikmah in Musa and Khadr. No one asked them to do the job. Khadr went and did the job, right? No one had set a wage, so they couldn't do that afterwards. Okay, you see the problem with Musa's claim?
Nah.
Continue.
It is not a condition for the validity of giving job wages to specify a certain person to perform the said task. However, in hiring, specifying the worker is a condition for its validity.
Nah, alhamdulillah, rabbil alameen. Anyone can do the job, or this is the person that I have hired. Hmm. You hire a particular company, you hire a particular person to do the job. This is why I see that. The other day, I flew from one country to another, and I made my tickets with a particular company. Then when I got went to go to the airline, they had transferred the flight that another company was going to fly out and do that flight. I said, who are they to change my flight? I didn't make an agreement with that company to fly me. I didn't agree with their conditions. I didn't do any of those things. You click for your flight, you agree for the conditions of the company that you're flying with. I said, these people, a contract means nothing to them anymore.
Hmm.
Okay? They can, at what they will, change even who you're flying with. When you specified that you are hiring this particular company for that job. And I said, this is illegal Islamically, you know. Continue.
Nah. Giving wages is a permissible agreement, which each of the two parties can cancel without the permission of the other. Yet hiring a person's service is a binding agreement that neither of the parties can cancel unless the other agrees.
Exactly.
Okay. Nah. Fuqaha maintain that whoever performs a task for another without stipulating a wage or taking the employer's permission deserves nothing as wages. This is because he thus performs...
Think about Musa and Khadr.
Nah. This is because he thus performs a task without stipulating compensation, so he deserves nothing in compensation, and he cannot enjoin the employer to do something the latter is not obliged to do. However, there are two exceptions in this case. First, if a worker, such as a broker, a porter, or the like, has prepared himself to do a certain service for a certain reward or wage when he performs the job, provided he has already taken the employer's permission, he deserves the specified wage, as it is a conventional practice. Yet he who has not already prepared himself to do the said service deserves nothing as a reward or wage, even if he has been permitted to do it, unless there has been a previous condition.
It's because a particular worker that is known for his work, or a broker or a porter, these are the services you expect from them. Okay, so, you know, when you see them, that's what they're doing. They deserve their wages for that. Okay? somebody else can't come and just do that and say they're going to. No, we don't. Who are you? Why are you doing this? Do you even work in this hotel? No, I don't. I don't have to pay you. Continue.
Nah. Second, if someone rescues another's property from damage or destruction, the former deserves an appropriate wage for this service, even if the owner has not given him permission to do it. This may happen in cases such as rescuing one's property from sinking in the sea, saving it from fire, or protecting it from imminent danger. Such a rescuer deserves an appropriate wage, as he is concerned about others' properties and keen on saving them from damage. Therefore, giving him a wage here urges him, as well as others, to maintain such a good deed, namely rescuing others' properties from damage and destruction.
Okay, so this is another convention that is known usually around the world, but not usually in the United States. People are expecting to receive a reward for helping you. Okay, and I thought when I first learned this, I thought, what, you know, selfish mentality this is, you know, and it's not selfish. It's, look, I helped you out, but yes, I expect you to do something for me because it could have been worse for you. Okay, and I went out of my way and helped you out, and I started to see people would stand around and look at you because they're waiting for their reward. Whereas in the United States, we think that this is optional to give the person a reward or not. And it's, we say, hey, he's going to walk away without a reward because he did it out of his own humanity. No, Islam states you have to give the person something. Okay? And the reason for that is because if you don't, then it would not encourage people to do the things they do. He finds your wallet with your important materials in it. He's not going to get any reward for it. He might just keep the wallet, take the money out, throw the wallet away, as opposed to giving you the whole thing back and you giving him some of the money. Continue.
Naam. Shaykh al-Islam ibn Taymiyyah, may Allah have mercy on him, said, whoever rescues another's property from destruction and returns it safe to the owner deserves an appropriate wage, even if there is no previous stipulation, according to the preponderant of the two opinions in this regard, as well as the opinion maintained by Imam Ahmad and other compilers of hadith.
Nah.
Moreover, the great Imam Ibn Qayyim, may Allah have mercy on him, said, if a person does something in favor of someone's property without the owner's permission to endear himself to the owner of the property, or if he does it to protect the latter's property and to preserve it from damage or loss, it is permissible for him, the rescuer, to ask for a compensatory wage for his service. This is the opinion maintained also by Imam Ahmad on many occasions.
Alhamdulillah. I think that's pretty clear. Okay? People are looking for an opportunity to help because they want something for themselves as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it is something that they have to do. The owner has to do. This is where we'll stop. Alhamdulillah, do I have any questions?
Sheikh, on the topic of jobs and job wages, are unions permissible?
Are unions permissible? And when you say unions, you mean that we put together an organization to vouchsafe our wages, to get fair wages and these things like that?
No, like collective bargaining, where there's also an element of like, well, I've never been part of a union, but I hear there's an element of force too. So if you're not with the union, then you're going to have some kind of penalty or be excluded in some way.
Well, you know, that comes by nature, that if they have a union that helps the people at the job and you're outside of the union, then that's going to hurt us. So there's kind of like competition, and we've seen that a lot, you know, whereas the people are not in the union, they are taking a less wage, they're taking some abuse, and other people want to have fair wages or what they call a livable wage and livable circumstances. There's going to be conflict between those two sides. I don't know the answer right off the top of my head. I cannot answer it.
No.
Alhamdulillah.
Okay, well, if there's no more questions on the topic, then we'll go ahead and close the class. Jazakallah khair, Sheikh, and thank you all for joining us today on Outlining Fiqh.
Amin wa yakum.
We learned a lot.
For you too.
Naam. Amin wa yakum. We learned a lot, but let's not rush things. If hadith, usul, and histories are still partially clouded in mysteries, then refrain yourself from speaking, for what can you teach? To have little knowledge and teach is to cheat. Go back to the graph and the knowledge within. There are 38 chapters to finish. Let's begin.